Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the Suffolk County Sheriff will stop holding detainees for ICE. He's standing by to tell us why. Also today, can Elizabeth Warren win over South Carolina's African-American voters from Joe Biden?
The African-American community in South Carolina remembers him because of Obama. That service, and plus he served well independent from just being the number two man. He did an excellent job.
Our reporter Anthony Brooks is there. We'll ask him. And black riders spend more time on average on MBTA buses than their white counterparts.
It took over an hour for a 23 bus to come when it's supposed to be running every 10 minutes. Where did the buses go? Why were the buses not going to the people who desperately needed the buses to show up?
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Suffolk County Sheriff's Department will no longer hold detainees for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Suffolk County Sheriff Stephen Tompkins announced he was ending his department's contract with ICE last night. And Sheriff Tompkins is here today with us in Studio 3 to tell us why. Sheriff Tompkins, welcome back to Radio Boston.
I love coming here. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. So why'd you do it? What motivated you to end the contract?
Here are a couple of things. First of all, the Framingham facility that houses women is going to be shut down for some renovations and do some things there. And so the state is going to move those ladies out anyway. And I believe the governor is going to move 200 or 300 to another state facility. And what I said was, look, the women from Essex, Plymouth, and Norfolk are more than welcome to come to our facility. And so we decided that we would do that for one reason, because that facility is being closed. But actually, if I'm honest with you, I don't have jurisdiction over the ICE detainees, but I do have some jurisdiction over the people that are going to be remanded to our care. And so with that said, men are with us for 12 to 14 months, ladies about 9 months. I can take that 9-month period with the ladies and really try to help them get back up on their feet. You know, and a lot of our ladies suffer from domestic violence, sexual exploitation, substance abuse, mental health issues. I have the resources and the staff that are really good at helping, you know. And so we do gender-specific programming, and I wanted to utilize our resources in that manner.
So what would you say to a listener who might be thinking, I'm not comfortable with the idea that a house of corrections is the place to address mental health, addiction, domestic violence? Why is this a good idea? Why is the House of Corrections a place?
I would start by saying I'm not comfortable with it either. That said, because of the scarcity of mental health beds and substance abuse beds and diversionary programs, we have become the de facto mental health, substance abuse, and in some cases, education facility. So my thing is, when people come to us, how do you want them to go home? In the same situation when they showed up? Or better. And our contention is that they should go back home in a better situation. So we're going to work mightily to do that. You know, my mandate is care, custody, and control. This falls under the heading of care.
Can you explain the numbers a little bit, both in terms of how many ICE detainees will not be there anymore and how many women you have, how many women you'll be expecting?
We presently have somewhere in the neighborhood of 65 to 80 women. We're going to be expecting about 200 to 250 ladies coming in, which actually starts tomorrow. The ladies from Norfolk arrive tomorrow. On the 15th, the ladies from Plymouth will come. And on the 22nd, we'll have the ladies from Essex. Conversely, we have about 180, 185 ICE detainees that will go to other facilities.
So this move has not been without controversy. Who is upset with you and why? For doing this.
Who isn't upset with me? No.
So that's interesting.
You know, it's a catch-22. You know, as I mentioned earlier, when we were working with ICE, people were protesting and mad that we were working with ICE. Okay, I understand that. And now that we want to reprioritize our resources, people are not happy about that for a very valid reason. And that reason is because they will probably have to travel further to see their friends and family.
So ICE's claim that that's one of the implications of this is a credible claim.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. So we have three other facilities in the Commonwealth, Bristol, Plymouth, and Hamden County out in Springfield. I will assume that some of these ladies or some of these folks may go to New York. They may go to the facility in Rhode Island.
So for critics who may say you're not supporting the federal government in detaining high-level offenders, which is what the detention of the ICE detainees, I used to use the same word like seven times in one sentence, mm-hmm. but you understand what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. What is your response to that?
My response is I was hired by the citizens of Suffolk County to work on their behalf. And so I'm working on the behalf of citizens of Suffolk County and the Commonwealth. It's not that I don't want to work with our federal partners. In fact, we do a whole host of things with our federal partners, state and local partners. But in this instance, when the country and the Commonwealth and my county, frankly, have a lot of people suffering from mental health and substance abuse, and I can do something about it, I choose to do that, you know, and people are going to be unhappy with me, and I totally get it. At the end of the day, a lot of these women have kids at home, okay? And do you want to send someone back home that is still challenged? Now, are we going to cure all of their ills and their problems? No. I get that. But the recidivism rate in the Commonwealth is 46%. So we know on Friday, half the people that will leave us on Friday will be back in 3 to 6 months. So why not interrupt that cycle of recidivism? Why not offer the care, which is a part of my mandate, to help them, and then team them up with social service agencies when they get out? And so it's do you want to help the federal government or do you want to help the local government, you know, and the local citizens? And in this case, I choose to work with the local individuals. We've been working with ICE since 2003. That's a good long time, you know. And so I just want to try something different.
The Boston Herald described your move as, quote, the latest clash between Massachusetts liberal pals and ICE, end quote. You know, we know Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins has spoken out against ICE repeatedly. She's even sued them. Did your politics play into this decision? What do you think of that argument?
My politics didn't play into this because I have no jurisdiction over ICE. I have no jurisdiction over the president. I have no jurisdiction over the federal government. I find it interesting and fascinating that people just do not want to believe that my department really wants to help people. I mean, come on.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think it's hard for people to believe that Sheriff Steve Tompkins wants to be of service to people?
Well, because, first of all, we're in a politically very intense environment these days on one side of the coin. And on the other side of the coin, I don't know, frankly. I wish I had an answer for you, but I will say this. I grew up in a household in Harlem. My mother suffered from alcohol abuse for quite some time. I have two female cousins, one who is now since deceased, that lived in the household with a pretty severe batterer. I'm old enough to remember the heroin epidemic in New York City. And so I know what drugs and alcohol and depression looks like, you see. And if I can do something to interrupt that, I'm going to. Whether people want to say, oh, you're just doing it because it's a political thing, well, that's on them. I can't change people's minds. I can try, but what I'd rather do is change the situation of those that have been overlooked and not seen very much, underserved and overseen. That's what I can do. That's what I'm going to do.
It has really been a mark of your tenure as sheriff that you have focused on issues of addiction, homelessness, mental health. I feel like you just laid out a blueprint from your own life as to why you're so passionate about those issues. Is that where it comes from?
It is, absolutely. I've lived it. You know, I lived it. And so at some point, I really, you know that adage, we are our brothers and sisters' keepers. I believe that. I believe it. And so I want to try to do something about that. There's that adage about the American dream, that ideal that says all citizens should have the opportunity to achieve success and prosperity through hard work and determination. Well, the American dream has bypassed the vast majority of people that are in my facility. Okay. 65% of my inmate population is black or brown or poor. You see.
Will that be true of the women that come in as well? Do you know roughly?
I don't know. To tell you the God's honest truth, I don't know. But I know what I have right now. And so I want to work with this population. I think that that's the rent that I pay to be on the planet, is to help.
So let's talk about a tricky dimension of that. As you well know, because you wrote an op-ed about this in August, the Boston police took an action in August that they have termed Operation Clean Sweep. Yeah. There are a lot of advocates who don't like that name for it, but I'm going to use it because it's what the police called it. You were supportive of the idea of the police targeting people who are selling drugs in the area. You also asked in your op-ed, quote, what do we do with those who are not dealers but victims? BOR did some research on the arrests afterward and discovered that really more than half of them were on previous warrants or on drug possession, not dealing. Knowing what we know now, are you in support of that police action and similar police actions?
So, yes, is the short answer, and I'll tell you why. For months, you drive to our facility on Bradson Street, you would drive past an open-air drug market. Now, I remember, as I say, the heroin epidemic in New York, but people used to find an alleyway or a hallway to shoot up. Today, they shoot up right outside in broad daylight. They fight in broad daylight. They defecate and fornicate in broad daylight.
Okay? And what is... This is going to sound like a naive question, but I think there's something underlying this. What's the difference between doing it in an alley... and coming around the corner out onto the sidewalk where the sun is shining? Do you understand what I'm asking?
The only difference is that they don't care where they're doing it, and they don't care. Back in the day, although I don't think people wanted to be heroin addicts, but they also didn't want to have friends of their families or their mom see them shooting up outside. You know, and so they would find a place to do what they had to do to self-medicate. Nowadays, all bets are off. They will self-medicate wherever and whenever they want to. And it was really bad. And so when Mayor Walsh and the Boston Police and others came in to do Operation Clean Sweep, it was well past time. I'm sorry. It was just well past time to clean that up. I mean,
will that work?
It's, you know what? Knock on wood, it's worked thus far.
You know,
It was because I'm there every day, you know. And so, at least in my catchment area, I'm not speaking about the bigger part of the city. But this was a collective effort between our department, the city of Boston, state police, Boston Medical Center, the fire department, EMS. You know, we all came together to talk about this. I don't know if you know, but back in the summer, one of my officers got into an altercation.
Came out of his car on his way into work.
You know, and, you know, I demanded a meeting with all of the appropriate agencies. Everybody came, they chimed in, and we had a good conversation. And then Kate Walsh over at Boston Medical Center with Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley had a subsequent meeting. And so far, so good. You know, that area, Atkinson Street, Bradson Street, has been pretty cleaned up. Now, my understanding is these folks may have filtered out into other areas of the city, but in our catchment area right now, it's pretty clean.
You and D.A. Rollins, it seems, have been simpatico on a number of policy issues since she came in. She's expressed dismay twice on our air about that operation, some concern about it. So, one, I want to ask your reaction to that. And then, two, how do you manage this tension between empathy and compassionate response for addiction and law enforcement?
Well, insofar as Rachel's whatever she had to say, I didn't hear it. So I can't really intelligently speak to that.
Fair enough.
So I don't know. The second part of your question, I'm sorry, is...
So, let me just say that she was concerned that after expressing solidarity and a sense of compassion, that Clean Sweep then came along. It was assertive, aggressive, caught up a lot of people who were not selling and was disproportionate and perhaps tilted too much towards the law enforcement side rather than the services side. Now, I'm characterizing what she said. She might characterize it differently.
Right. Well, a lot of the people that were picked up also had warrants. And so, you know, they just hadn't been enforced. So they got scooped up there. Listen, you're going to have the yin and the yang. Some days things are going to be sweetness and light, and some days it's going to be gloom and doom. Now, I'm not trying to be cavalier or cute here, but you're not going to be able to please all the people all the time, and that action needed to be taken, you see. But let me just say this about what Rachel is saying, particularly her list of 15 offenses that she would not prosecute. And she and I have talked about this, so I'm not speaking out of school here. Some of those I don't agree with, frankly. But what I will
say— Can you give an example?
Resisting arrest.
Okay.
Breaking and entering and sleeping in someone's dwelling, even if that place is, abandoned. Muling of drugs. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, you got to do something about that. You have to arrest them. But I get where she's coming from. But the thing I like about what she's doing is that it's got the conversation, the temperature of the conversation turned up mightily. And as I say, 65% of my population is black or brown. In a commonwealth with that same demographic is 18%. How do you get 65 out of 18%? You got a broken system. And something's got to be done about that. And so she's shining a light on that. And change is hard. And change is hard in public safety, in policing, in a quasi-militaristic environment like my department. But you know what? It's got to happen. We have to evolve, you know? And so people are going to say and try to effectuate some things that other people won't agree with. But at the end of the day, I'm hoping that we all find common ground and work on this collectively.
All right. That is Suffolk County Sheriff Stephen Tompkins. Thanks for being with us here at Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Stay with us. Coming up, WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks will join us from the campaign trail in South Carolina. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. As the Democratic presidential candidates begin preparing for next week's debate, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is leading in a number of both national and state polls. She's ahead in early voting states of Iowa, New Hampshire, but former Vice President Joe Biden continues to hold a big advantage in key South Carolina, thanks to deep support among African American voters. WBUR's Anthony Brooks is in South Carolina, and he joins us now from Columbia. Welcome, Anthony.
Hi, Tiziana.
I'm tempted to ask you about the weather, but we should probably just dive right in.
80 degrees and beautiful.
Yeah, I'm jealous. So listen, Senator Warren is holding a town hall event there tonight at South Carolina State University in Orangeburg. What's the event about?
Right. Well, she's doing a couple of events in South Carolina today. First in Charleston, where she held a roundtable on environmental justice. And this is happening as she announces a new plan to address climate change, which, among other things, would direct $1 trillion to the most vulnerable communities over the next decade to clean up pollution and invest in development. And then this evening, as you mentioned, at South Carolina State University, she's going to be with Congressman Jim Clyburn to talk about proposed legislation on student loan debt relief, which would eliminate $50,000 in student loan debt from some 40 million Americans. So she's going from the southern part of the state up here to Columbia toward the north.
So environmental justice, student debt, are there any other major issues that she's been talking about or that you anticipate she will talk about while she's down there?
Well, she's made several trips to this important early primary state, and really she's bringing her full campaign message here, hoping that her call for, you know, what she calls big structural changes will resonate, particularly with the state's African-American voters who represent a very important constituency within the Democratic Party. And from the start, Warren has talked about the challenges that afflict working families, hitting communities of color particularly hard. And she's really been talking about that since she announced for the presidency back in at the end of last year. So she's hoping that her call for a wealth tax, free early childhood education, debt-free college, health care for all, big investments in historically black colleges will be well received here.
You've said that she's hoping that these big changes, these big investments will resonate. So let me ask you, are they? Do you think her message is starting to resonate there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. I mean, it has to be said that Joe Biden still has a substantial lead over Warren and all the other Democrats in this state. But just recently, the Warren campaign announced a big eight-figure digital and TV advertising campaign across a number of early voting states, including South Carolina. And she's becoming better known here. Just anecdotally, when I sort of talk to people, they're either for Biden or they're for Warren or they're for Biden and say, yeah, but I'm thinking of Warren. I mean, I hear that a lot. So yesterday I spoke to State Representative Wendy Brawley of Columbia. She supported Bernie Sanders in 2016, but now she says she's with Warren because of her focus on a number of key issues, which she described this way.
Closing some of the gaps and disparities that exist for us in healthcare and housing and education and environmental justice, criminal justice. If she continues to stay focused on those issues, which she has been, you know, throughout this campaign, I think when more people hear that message in South Carolina, it's going to serve the African-American vote very well.
So that's a hopeful voice from a Warren supporter. But as you note, Biden is holding on to a lead there. How is he keeping such a strong advantage, especially with black voters?
Well, I mean, I guess there are a couple of reasons. First of all, his history. He's been traveling to South Carolina for decades, and voters here know him. He's got the support of lots of older African-American leaders in the state. He also benefits in a big way from the fact that he was Barack Obama's vice president for 8 years, a fact that means a lot to lots of African-American voters down here. So here's Jim Felder. He's a veteran South Carolina activist. He's a former state legislator, a former local director of the NAACP with deep, deep roots in the Democratic Party, talking about why his community is so comfortable with Joe Biden.
The African-American community in South Carolina remembers him because of Obama, that service. And plus, he served well, independent from just being the number two man. He did an excellent job. So we had the largest voter turnout in South Carolina during Obama's election. But we see signs out there now that it's going to come up again because of Biden if he is the nominee, and I think he will be.
So let's talk about something else having to do with Joe Biden. He's making news today in New Hampshire. For the first time today, he officially called for President Trump to be impeached, not support an impeachment inquiry, but impeach the president. How much of an effect do you think that's going to have on the race, especially in the next couple of weeks?
You know, I don't see it having a huge effect. I mean, what I see happening there is Joe Biden is really coming around to where the Democratic Party has arrived, essentially. Keep in mind, Elizabeth Warren was sort of out in front on this. Last April, she called for the impeachment of President Trump, and slowly a lot of the other candidates have come around. And as we know, a lot of those members of Congress from those purple districts have come around. So I just see Biden essentially landing where most of the Democrats are landing, given what's going on in Washington.
So, okay, I don't want to go all Seinfeld on you, but we're up in Boston, and I got to ask, what is the deal with South Carolina? Why is it such a big deal in the primary season? And, you know, what's the hold South Carolina has on the election?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, it's important because South Carolina, first of all, it's an early primary. It follows Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada. And it's the first Democratic primary in the South where African Americans make up the majority of the Democratic electorate. And Tiziana, you could say something sort of more to the point. In a sense, it's the first primary that actually looks like America. And it takes place just 3 days before Super Tuesday, when Massachusetts, by the way, votes and more than a dozen other states vote. And about half of them are in the South, and several of them will be largely determined by African-American voter turnout. So the thinking is doing well in South Carolina will propel you into Super Tuesday. And so it means a whole lot. And I think it means more and more, especially this year.
So let's go back to Elizabeth Warren for a minute. Last night, she told CBS News that if she becomes the nominee, she will decline big money donations in the general election.
So long as it's the wealthy and well-connected who finance the presidential elections, then we're going to continue to have a government that works really great for the wealthy and the well-connected and just not work for much of anyone else.
That's a change. Previously, she had said she had coined it unilateral disarmament to do that in the general election against Donald Trump. So what changed, and is this a big deal?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, Warren's campaign says this isn't a reversal, but, quote, a clarification, since the original version was a little vague, end quote. But if anything has changed, it's that Warren has done incredibly well for going big money contributions. I mean, just in the last 3 months, she's raised $24.6 million from 940,000 small donors. That's second only to Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who raised a little more. But this has become part of her brand and part of her intention to run a grassroots campaign. So if she's rising in the polls, if the money is still rolling in, you know, I think her conclusion is if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I think she's happy to stick with this strategy.
So you mentioned that that's part of her brand. Another part of her brand has really been her personal narrative. It's been a big part of her campaign.
Right.
It came up last night on the CBS interview. There have been questions raised this week. She has an anecdote she often tells about being a teacher in 1971 and being shown the door when it became obvious she was pregnant. Conservative news outlets, including Fox, have been making a big deal about this, calling it into question. What do we know?
Well, so this story was first published by the conservative Washington Free Beacon, and as you suggested, was picked up by Fox News and some other outlets. The original story was missing some key context, which CBS provided with a follow-up report that basically corroborated Warren's basic point. It quoted a teacher saying, quote, "You pretty much had to leave if you were pregnant." And so here's how Warren put it in that interview that you mentioned on CBS.
When they didn't know I was pregnant, they gave me the job and said, "You're hired for the next year. It's yours, kid." And when they discovered I was pregnant, they said, "Oops, no, we're going to hire someone else for the job. It's not yours."
All right. So setting that specific example aside, I'm going to ask you sort of a meta question on this. Since she makes her personal story such a big part of her campaign, has she opened herself up to more or a different kind of scrutiny? And does that make her vulnerable or impact her in any specific ways going forward, especially as she rises in the polls?
Well, I mean, the last point is the one I would jump on. I mean, look, she's arguably the front runner or close to it. So that means there is going to be new scrutiny on her statements, on her past, on her record. That's normal stuff in any political race. And that's as it should be. But obviously, it's incumbent on the press to get the facts right and provide all the necessary context. As far as using her personal story, whether it's going to open her up to more risk, you know, it might, but that's really part of her brand and her message. I mean, she's very successfully linked her personal story, growing up on the ragged edge of the middle class, with a series of these policy proposals or plans. So it's really part of her brand, and I think you're going to see her continuing to use that personal story to make her case as she travels around the country. I don't see her backing off from that.
You mentioned that scrutiny, you know, is a normal part of the political race. There are parts of this cycle that don't feel normal to me. And one of the things that really struck me, there's been this scramble this week to find out whether she was technically fired or laid off or resigned on her own from a teaching job she held 48 years ago. And at the same time, we have a president who routinely tells indisputable lies. On Monday, he said that when he came into the White House, the military was out of ammunition. So that feels like a double standard. Can we expect these two parties to be held to different standards in 2020 in the race? And what does that mean for campaigning?
Well, I mean, I hope they are held to the same standard. Look, I mean, I think the press was rightly criticized in 2016 for this idea of false equivalencies on a number of issues and their coverage of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I mean, it's okay to ask if an anecdote that Warren offers lines up with the facts. But as you're suggesting, Tiziana, let's not confuse questions like those with the amount of coverage we devote to it with, let's say, allegations that a sitting president asked a foreign government to intervene in our election. I mean, it's important to get the balance right. And I think that was one of the lessons of 2016. And I hope it's one that we have absorbed and can display as we move forward.
That is WBUR's Anthony Brooks in Columbia, South Carolina. Anthony, thanks.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We all know that transportation in Boston can be a challenge under the best of circumstances. For Black bus riders, that can mean spending 64 hours more per year on the bus than to white counterparts. The Livable Streets Alliance has responded to that 2017 finding from the Metropolitan Area Planning Council with a new report which calls on the MBTA to prioritize equity in its bus service by boosting its fleet, making commutes shorter, and significantly expanding routes, especially those that serve many people of color. Joining us now is Stacey Thompson, who is the executive director of the Livable Streets Alliance and a co-author on the report. Stacey, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
We are also joined by Mella Bush Miles, who is the director of transit-oriented development and the T-Riders Union at Alternatives for Community and Environment. She's also a former special advisor to the Fairmont Indigo Transit Coalition. Mella, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And let's hear from you on this. Do you think equity is a priority issue for the MBTA? Are you a bus rider of color familiar with these issues? Tell us about your experiences. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Okay, let's begin at the beginning. Stacey, why did you write this report?
We wrote this report because we talked about the 64-hour statistic in a previous report, and it really stuck. And the Globe talked about it, and BUR talked about it. And we said, well, instead of talking about it, what if we tried to solve the problem? What would it take? We've been talking to folks like Mela for years. They've told us there weren't enough buses. So we said, let's look into it. We did simple analysis with the T's own data, with census data, and it turns out we just simply need more buses, and that more buses and more service alone would go a long way to fill that equity gap.
And I just a clarifying question there. If I read the report correctly, mm-hmm. more buses to meet the current standards,
yes.
not even future needs or growth in population or increased congestion, et cetera. Is that correct?
Yes. Today, if you are taking the bus system, the MBTA bus system, you will not meet its service standards. It is 67 buses short from meeting its own service standards, let alone being able to fill the equity gap in our Black and brown communities.
Okay. So the set of recommendations you've come up with, they go along with the MBTA's Better Bus Project, which is part of an $8 billion modernization initiative that includes subway fleets, updated tracks, and reinventing the bus system. What recommendations do you make to add to the Better Bus Project?
Sure. The recommendations are threefold. The first is build more bus garages today. That is the key limiting factor in having enough space for buses, for electric buses of the future. Build at least two when we identified land where they could do that on land they own today. Secondarily, order at least 200 additional buses. They could order 400 or 500 and put them to good use, but at least 200 and do that today. And then third, and perhaps most importantly, is build out a good way to measure the equity impacts of the system. Cities like Seattle, like San Francisco, have worked out really great mechanisms for actually determining if they are properly serving communities of color, and we can learn from those cities and adapt and build our own ways to measure our impact properly.
1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK is the line. What is your lived experience on the MBTA? Do you take the bus? Is it sufficient? Do you wait too long? Are there enough buses available to you? Do you feel safe? Call and share your experiences. Mela, let me turn to you. The report already indicates that the MBTA is essentially underservicing on bus lines. There's a lot of information about disparities in communities of color. What is the lived experience of people who are being underserved by the MBTA buses?
I'll speak about something we call ghost buses.
Great.
You're standing waiting for a bus to come, and you have some app, and you're watching it count down. You might be in Dudley Station, and you'll see the bus is arriving, the bus is arriving, the bus is arriving. And then all of a sudden, the bus disappears off of that app or off of that countdown clock. And the next thing you know, it says next bus, 21 minutes or 20 plus, which means we don't know when that bus is ever going to come. So people get ghosted. They get left. We get left standing on platforms, standing out in the cold. The subway broke down. Oh, how would that impact a bus rider? Because there are insufficient buses to go around, if the subway breaks down, they have to provide some alternative service to the subway riders, so they send buses over. Where did they get the buses from? There are no extra buses or drivers. They take them out of the community and send them over to the subway riders, and the subway riders are accommodated because of that diversion. But folks are left standing, for example, on the 23 bus line, which has no other alternative but that one bus. We've been standing there 45 minutes, an hour. Sometimes you just think the bus is never going to come. I've walked all the way from Four Corners to Dudley, and the bus came when I was almost to Dudley Station.
So, Mela, that's got me thinking of that old thing about the butterfly effect, right? So, you know, the butterfly flaps its wings and there's a hurricane on some other part of the planet. 45 minutes, unreliable. I can't be sure the bus is coming. How does that effect wave out into the rest of everyday life?
You're late. You're late for work. You may lose your job. You may be working minimum wage jobs. You may have to pick up your child. If you're late to picking the child up from daycare, after the time that they're supposed to be picked up, it starts, the meter goes up, and you have to pay $1 a minute for every minute that you're late. It is going to hit you in the pocket. It can cause you to lose your job. You may be late for school. You may be kept back. We've had all of these things be reported back to us from students, from the youngest person to the oldest person.
So, Stacey, some colleagues and I, when I was at Boston College, used federal data sets and looked at these challenges. Yeah. And what we found was that race and low-income status definitely made you, first, more likely to use buses mm-hmm. as your form of transportation than other forms of public transportation. And second, to have longer commute times. Third, that those two things were intersectional, that yep. the intersection of your race and your socioeconomic status would compound those problems.
Yep.
So this is not a uniquely Boston challenge, correct?
It is not a uniquely Boston challenge. You know, the legacy of redlining lives on. And what we would really like the MBTA to do is to say that systemic inequity exists, that systemic racism exists, and that we have a legacy of it. If we don't actually look at the legacy of systemic racism and try to pinpoint solutions, then we're going to continue to exist in this unvirtuous circle that you were talking about, where, you know, low-income and communities of color are disproportionately impacted. They can't get to jobs and services, and then they remain in that low-income status and sort of going in circles. We, you know, I think the beauty of this report is that working with our community partners, we're just asking for more buses. We're not asking for a multi-billion-dollar 20-year plan. This is just more buses is one step toward addressing that problem.
I sort of already know the answer to this, yeah. but when I hear you say we're asking for more buses, not a multi-billion-dollar plan, of course, the first reaction is, well, buses aren't cheap. So aren't you asking for a lot more?
No. I mean, we are expanding commuter rail service to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars for a relatively small population. The bus network serves significantly more people than the commuter rail does. It is expensive, but we, you know, can build two facilities, get 200 more buses, and have those serving 100,000 additional people in less than 5 years.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Do you see evidence of systemic racism, of systemic inequity in public transportation? Have you lived that experience and what has it meant to you? Call and share your stories during the conversation. So I'm going to add another voice. I want to add a different policy perspective. To do that, I'm going to bring in Greg Sullivan, the research director at the Pioneer Institute, which is an independent, nonpartisan, privately funded research organization that seeks to improve the quality of life in Massachusetts. Greg, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So, Greg, what's your reaction to the report's findings and its recommendations?
Well, first of all, I'd say that this is a terrific report. It's really unusually great because Livable Streets has laid out a rich history and background, but more importantly, it's made very specific, detailed, data-driven recommendations, and you don't see that every day. It was written by Andrew McFarland, who was the lead author, Ari Ofsivit, who everybody knows about. Ari, he's a great man. So this is...
And Stacey Thompson here in the studio.
Yeah, really, really encourage people to read this, especially I would encourage members of the state legislature to read it. So that's my general observation. The Pioneer Institute has been very, very heavily involved in making recommendations about the MBTA. So anyway, I take my hats off to this organization for having produced such an excellent report.
Greg, is there anything that you think the report is missing, or are there any recommendations that you thought were too big or too much or an overreach?
No. I would say, you know, what we have here is a unique argument that I haven't heard, which is linking in the concept that when you have huge swaths of the city in Greater Boston area, which do not have rapid transit service, they have bus service or no service, then you have created an inequity, and it breaks down and blossoms into a racial inequity. Now, that is really powerful and completely believable to me. And I think that that's kind of hasn't been part of the dialogue, but it's a very valid argument. So that's why I think that it's adding something new and something very important.
So one last question for you, Greg, and then I'm going to ask you to stay on for the rest of the conversation. Let's say funding wasn't an issue, and tomorrow the Fiscal Management Control Board allocated everything that was necessary. How would one proceed? What would be essential for doing this successfully?
When I read this report, when I was reading this report, I was thinking that a transit bus costs about $300,000. That's a round figure. So even though 200 times $300,000, that sounds like a lot of money, but not in the scheme of an $8 billion capital investment. But the report points out that in order to facilitate the additional buses, you have to have at least two garages.
A place
that's
to put
a big
them.
Deal. And you have to have storage sites. The report even identifies the storage sites, which was like we were referring to before, which is really very admirable. But I want to make my pitch about an alternative approach that I think would support livable streets in that arguments. Is that so? Around the country, many transit agencies have outsourced bus service. In fact, over the last 10 years, the outsourced bus service has gone up by 93% ridership, while
non-outsourced
has
gone down. Are you privatizing the MBTA?
Huh?
Are you privatizing the bus service on the MBTA?
Well, the MBTA does have a little tiny bit of outsourced bus service, but it doesn't. But by and large, it doesn't. Like 99.8% that is all done by employees. So what I'm saying is that if you outsourced bus service for expanded service, the vendor provides the buses, the drivers, repairs the facility, and stores it. So we advanced this idea, and it really had made a lot of headway. In fact, the governor's office supported this. To outsource one third. In the end, they didn't do it, though.
So, Greg Sullivan, I want to check in with Mela on this because I think I saw your eyebrows go up a little bit. As a resident, as an advocate, what's your reaction to that proposal?
Public transit is public transit. It is being paid for by the taxpayers. We support it. We pay for it with sales tax, gas tax, all kinds of taxes go into that. This is our public transportation system, and it's a public good. Privatization and union busting is not something that we would ever support, whether it's the riders are not asking for that. You have dedicated employees who have been working there 30, 40 and more years, working in these systems. Sending it outside to some private system takes the power out of the people and away from the people, and we do not support such a thing.
So let me follow up on that, Stacey, and ask, to the extent that if privatization would allow for greater efficiency and therefore more investment in more buses, in more frequent participation in routes, et cetera, is there anything attractive in that?
What I would say is that privatization is not a silver bullet. There's sort of this dream that if we bring the private sector in, it will magically solve our problems. And I can't actually look to very many examples where that is true. There are sometimes very unique case sets where it's helpful to have a private contractor. But I would agree with Mela in that we have a great body of men and women who I spent time with in a bus garage just a couple of weeks ago who are really experts, who are really good at their job. And if we are concerned about efficiencies in the way that the T operates and the way that staff operates, then that is where the governor should be spending some time and attention to make sure that we support those men and women.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Tom from Brighton's on the line. Tom, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Hi. Yeah, one thing, I'm really glad you're doing this program and attention is finally really being paid to the bus system. One thing that's always struck me is the amount of time and effort and money and attention that bike lanes get. How much we're putting into that kind of infrastructure versus buses. You know, I ride the 57, finally the partial bus lane in one direction. There's been a bike lanes all along that, Philadelphia and in other parts of Brighton, Alston, and the region for years. And I think a lot of it's just who uses buses and who uses bikes.
So, Tom, I'm going to take it back from you there just because your line's a little bit poor quality. You're cutting in and out. Stacey does want to respond to that, though, so I'm going to let her do that. Go ahead, Stacey.
Yeah, so my organization actually worked very closely with the city on that bus priority project. And I would actually say that the bigger issue is that both the bus system and the bike system have been underserved for a very long time. The city of Boston is moving much more slowly than their urban counterparts across the country in terms of building bike infrastructure. In our Black and Brown communities, they also don't have safe biking infrastructure, and any of our EJ partners will tell you that. So I would say that we need to stop prioritizing single occupancy vehicles and start prioritizing modes that move people more efficiently, which is people who can walk, people who can bike, and people on buses.
So, Mela, at the opening, we talked about the 64-hour per year differential between an African-American rider and a white rider. That is such a staggering number. What will it take for the city the MBTA, to embrace the racial dimension of this inequity and make investments to change it? Does the MBTA, do you think that there's a will and a desire there to do it and the public needs to support it? How do we gain traction?
Well, first of all, the Fiscal Management Control Board is about to be, what do we call it, sundowned. Their terms will end. It was a 3 to 5 year project and they'll be gone. Prior to them coming on, we had worked to get community voices onto the board of directors, and we had a seat carved out for that. And then when Governor Baker came in, he dismantled that board and installed this fiscal management control board. If we can get the voices of the people and the riders in so that real riders, people with real-time lived experiences, can actually get onto those boards and be able to have those conversations and be able to be the change, I think that we can move the needle on some of these things. It's because there's a disconnect. You're putting people on the board who may not have any experience in transportation planning. We have someone who's an amazing housing specialist, and she's on that board. But she doesn't really fully understand what's happening. And so the way that we're going to move it is to change what's going on at the MBTA, because you don't know a person's experience until you rode a mile on their bus.
All right, so let's bring in a caller voice there who I think will add to your point. Kira from Concord, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Hi, Stacey. Hi, Tantia. Hi, Stacey, and hi, Mela.
Hi, Kira. Go ahead.
Hi, Tantia, and you all, I am interested to know about whether the buses are also helping. I'm a CNA in health aid. And I was wondering about also accommodations for people of all kinds who have challenges, physical challenges. And I was wondering if it's going to be that I'm pretty sure it's going to come to be. It's just a matter of time and money.
Okay, Kira, thank you for that. We're very short on time, so I want to turn back to Stacey. What about the dimension of people with disabilities?
Yeah, no, I mean, this is actually critical. We have a high number of people who have mobility issues who use our bus service every day. And, you know, another reason to consider, you know, the state has a mandate to make sure that our buses are ADA compliant. That can get muddled with privatization. So another value add to make sure it takes care of all people. But this actually goes back to the city. We only 8% of our bus stops have shelters, and we need accessible sidewalks and other ways to make our bus system more accessible. So I totally hear you.
Okay. And Greg Sullivan, you know, 30 seconds or less, what is your reaction to the question of governance and how to get more community participation in governance?
Well, the Livable Streets report calls for a member of the ridership community to be on the Fiscal Management Control Board. I think the Fiscal Management Control Board is going to be renewed, by the way. But I agree with that, and I think that's a very sound suggestion.
Okay, and Mela, one last thought from you. What do you want listeners to understand that they may not know about bus equity?
There's a real challenge. Race and class are major issues in the decisions that are made and how people are left out of those decisions. A lot of the planning that happens does not fully engage black and brown people in the planning. They make meetings at times when people cannot come. They don't properly reach out to the community and don't fully engage so that we can actually have our voices heard.
Okay, that is Mella Bush Miles, who's the Director of Transit-Oriented Development and the T-Riders Union at Alternatives for Community Engagement. Thanks for being here. Stacey Thompson, Executive Director of Livable Streets Alliance, co-author of the report. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Greg Sullivan, Research Director at the Pioneer Institute. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.